And we also have three distinguished guest presenters with us today. Their bios were sent on the event announcement, but I'll briefly go over them here. Dr. John Parsons is a financial economist specializing in risk management and corporate finance. Dr. Parsons is the head of the MBA finance track at MIT's Sloan School of Business. Jonathan Thiemann is the founder and president of Thiemann Investment Advisors. He is a former president at Rogers Casey Asset Management, chief investment strategist of Barclays Global Investors, and chief investment officer for MyVest Corporation. He formerly taught finance at Harvard Business School and served on the Economic Advisory Board of FINRA from 2005 to 2010. And Wally Turbeville is a senior fellow at Demos, previously a vice president at Goldman Sachs and the CEO of VMAC, which was a derivatives risk management group. And the way we're going to organize today's call is that each of us, myself and the three guest presenters will speak briefly for 5 to 7 minutes, and then we will open the floor for questions. We should be able to get 20 to 30 minutes for questions on this topic. So I just wanted to start by kind of giving an overview of why we're here today and why bond market liquidity seems to have become the hottest issue in financial regulation and in DC. And it's a little bit of a buzzword to some degree, bond market liquidity. It's a very broad general kind of thing. But it's actually very difficult to define. When you look at the bond markets and you ask about the fundamental function of the bond markets, which is serving the real economy and providing money to non-financial companies and to governments who need to borrow money to take risk, the bond markets actually look pretty healthy. If you look at my presentation on the second page, you can see that each of the last 3 years, 2012 through 2014, corporate bond issuance has been in excess of historical averages. If you look at page 3, you could see that the risk spreads for typical corporate bonds are quite low, meaning that it's not that expensive for people who want to borrow money in the corporate bond market to access capital. And if you look at page 4, of course, you hardly need a chart to show this, but the U.S. government, of course, has been issuing enormous volumes of bonds over the past 5 years since the crisis, and has managed to pay very, very low rates on treasuries on a sustained basis. In fact, historically low rates on treasuries. So if we just look at the ways that the bond market serves the real economy, it seems to be humming along. So what is the problem here? Well, what we've had is we've had people within the markets raise issues about what one might call the internal market plumbing in the bond markets. And as I said, these don't seem to be affecting the ability of the bond markets to serve the real economy, but they are raising some concerns. And those concerns have been heightened by a couple of anomalous trading days in the bond markets. The October 2014 events in the Treasury bond market, the so-called taper tantrum in mid-2013 in the fixed income markets, where there was a sell-off due to concern about the Fed raising rates, and these events have raised concerns because they're just anomalous in terms of the speed of price changes and disruptions that we're seeing on a one-day basis in these markets. So some of the indicators in terms of the internal plumbing of markets that people point to are a decline in average trade size, that it takes more trades to move the same dollar volume. There isn't a decline in overall secondary market trading. There's plenty of volume of secondary market trading, but there's some decline in the ratio of trades to outstanding securities. We have a lot more, for example, treasury bonds in the markets, and the number of trades per bond seems to have dropped, though it's a little unclear why you would expect trading volumes to go up, you know, in lockstep with the volume of bonds that are there. And we also have market insiders raising concerns and complaining about a decline in balance sheet capacity for bank dealers. Prior to the crisis, it was very easy for banks and for broker dealers to particularly bank broker dealers to purchase large bond inventories, essentially using borrowed money. And the new capital regulations and new rules such as the Volcker Rule have made it more necessary for banks to either justify those purchases in terms of customer service or to raise their own equity to back up those purchases. So the questions are, do these internal market issues interfere with the flow of credit to the real economy? And as I've said, I'm not sure we really see evidence that they do. And that's a problem of transactional liquidity and a problem of potential systemic liquidity. Could these changes in market plumbing create negative effects during market stress and possibly create some form of systemic risk? And the concerns there are hypothetical, I think, but they, in the sense that they haven't really materialized, even those one-day events I mentioned did not turn out to be systemic events. But the concern is that there could be some kind of lack of shock absorption capacity in the markets, either due to smaller dealer inventories or less capacity to make large sales, and that if there was a sell-off, then that could lead to more rapid price declines. And what are the implications for regulation here? So just to quickly finish off on page 7 in my presentation, I talk about one of the regulatory options, and we're getting pressure, I think, from some of these bank dealers to sort of roll back some of the Dodd-Frank regulations and some of the Basel regulations to make it easier to build up inventories. And that would be what I call a return to the good old days, where, as you can see in that chart on page 7, there was a massive run-up in dealer inventories, an increase of between 1 and 1.5 trillion over 10 years in dealer inventories prior to the financial crisis. And far from providing shock absorption, we saw that during the financial crisis, there was a very abrupt and rapid sell-off in these inventories. Over 2007 to 2009, there were sales of $400 billion out of these inventories, before the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act, before the passage of the new Basel rules. So far from providing shock absorbency, it seems that that building up those very large inventories on borrowed money led to pressures to sell. And I think another question on the final page of my presentation is, to what degree are these issues driven by emerging risks that are new risks that perhaps we need to think about new forms of regulation for? And that includes the increasing role of electronic trading, especially predatory high-speed electronic trading in the markets, and the need for asset managers and funds to prepare for liquidity management in case of a sell-off. And both of these are on the regulatory agenda, but it's as yet unclear what actual results we're going to see from those. So that was an attempt to give a quick map of the territory, and our next three presenters will dive into more detail here. Wally Turbeville is going to be presenting next. Wally?
Thanks, Marcus, and thanks for all of you for joining us today. What I would like to do is sort of establish a framework, set the table, if you will, for Jonathan and John to in more depth and get into exactly what is and is not going on in the markets. If you take a look at the first page of my presentation, it's actually page number 2, Federal Reserve's view of the bond market liquidity. One thing to address here is that when we talk about bond market liquidity, of course, we're talking about corporate bond market liquidity. And as far as the Treasury markets are concerned, the Fed here, this is from the Monetary Policy Report, July 15th, 2015, so just a couple of weeks ago. And in response to some of the storm and drang, if you will, associated with the discussions of liquidity, the Fed commented here that based on their metrics, liquidity in the nominal Treasury markets did not indicate notable deteriorations. What they mean here by this is on the very next page that shows the two charts that they used. One was looking at bid-ask spreads over time on the 10-year on-the-run Treasury notes, the 10-year notes that are in the market and liquid, and noting that the bids to buy and the offers to sell have not spread out, meaning that there are good tight markets in terms of price. Then they look on to the similar measurement, which is market depth, meaning at a given price, the best price going to buy or sell. How deep is the interest to buy or sell behind that price? And what they've determined is that the Treasury markets are seem to be working very well in terms of liquidity. Now, why is that important to the corporate bond market? The reason is the corporate bond market, the prices really are off of our percentages of the Treasury market prices of on the run bonds, meaning that the corporate bond market is basically a function of the Treasury bond market. And so, as long as there's liquidity in the Treasury bond market, then there's sort of a natural support for the corporate bond market. Now, that doesn't mean that there wouldn't be a difference in pricing in the corporate bond markets. It doesn't mean there might be anomalies in the Treasury bond markets. Marcus has pointed out in October 2014 there indeed was. But let's talk about in a little more depth what that means, the price issues and the market integrity issues. The next chart, page number 4, is a quote from Douglas Hodge, who's the CEO of PIMCO. And the point he's making here is that there's a difference between transactions and market integrity. Liquidity supports both of those things, but they're very different and one shouldn't confuse them. So let's take a look at what he means by the transactional liquidity, and that's on page number 5. What we have here is a fictional market, of course. Bonds to be purchased. Let's say there's $10 million worth of bonds to be purchased. And there's several levels of selling interest in the market. Here we see $7.5 million worth of interest to sell at 95%, $12.5 million at 96, $30 million at 97, and $150 at 100. What that means here is that to get $10 million sold, you will transact at 96 because that's what it takes to finish up the sale. So in that sense, there's interest in the market, there's liquidity in the market, and a price will be set. In this particular case, the very best price, there's not enough interest to get the job done, but in the next price there is. So small transactions get done that way. Next page, page 6, large transactions are often a different kettle of fish. In this particular case, it's the same situation, but instead of $10 million of bonds to be purchased, the interest to purchase is $65 million, much larger number. In this particular case, it goes all the way through the tiers so that the price, instead of being 96% of par, in our little made-up example, it's 100% of par, meaning that it's a higher price to if someone wants to purchase a large amount of bonds. And that becomes important, and both John and Jonathan will talk about what that means. It means that it's possible with less liquidity and less depth in the market, that you could have different price outcomes. But that doesn't mean that that will affect market integrity. And the next page, page 7, is from a story, Bloomberg Business, and back in October, just relating to that that bond market situation where prices went up. There was a flood of interest to buy in the market because of international events. Prices went up, and here is a quote from a from an individual, Mr. Comiskey, from Bank of Nova Scotia, who said basically turn the machines off, meaning all of the electronic trading machines got turned off by him. It's sort of quaint that it wasn't automatic. He seems to say he's doing it, did it himself. But it was because as prices started changing, this way going up, this situation, he didn't want to acquire more inventory with markets moving so fast. So often what happens when market integrity is risk is happening because of lack of liquidity is because liquidity exits the market via these electronic means. Machines get turned off. Either they turn themselves off or they are turned off by somebody because to avoid automatic transactions. So the final page of the presentation describes what happens when a market integrity event occurs. In this case, there's not millions, but billions of dollars of bonds that are to be sold. So at time in, there's a certain depth of market. Time in plus one, there's a huge desire to sell. And so it blows through all that and then will bottom out somewhere. Now, this could be a one-day event, as we've seen, or it could be something that's much deeper. Probably something that's much deeper in the sort of a fire sale situation as we saw in 2008, where it was unrecoverable, happens at a much greater scale. So with the stability of the treasury market and its relationship to the corporate bond market, that's not so likely. So that sort of sets the table and describes the framework, and I suppose we'll go on to the rest of the presenters to describe further what's going on. Thanks.
Okay, Jonathan Thiemann?
Yes. I'd like to thank everyone for being with us today as well. From my point of view, the big problem in talking about bond market liquidity is that it's so difficult to measure. And in particular, the type of liquidity that I'm concerned with as an investor and as someone who gives service to investors, which is the issue of whether when I go to buy or sell in the market, will the other side of the trade be there at a reasonable price? The paper that I've got in the packet and the couple of graphs from it represent some work I've done to identify a proxy that we can use, not particularly to measure exactly what bond market liquidity is, but to tell us whether liquidity is good or poor and whether it's improving or deteriorating. And that proxy is the premium or discount on fixed income exchange traded funds. And unfortunately, it's a little bit technical, and I'll have to take you through a little bit of it. But to understand how this measure works, we need to think a little bit about how exchange traded funds or ETFs work. As I'm sure you know, an ETF is a fund, much like a mutual fund, that holds a portfolio of securities. It's a published portfolio, and in fact, the structure works best when the portfolio represents a published index. But unlike regular mutual funds where you buy and sell at net asset value at the end of the day, in ETFs you can buy and sell throughout the day in the market. But these are secondary market transactions where you're buying and selling existing shares. And what that means is the market prices at which you trade aren't necessarily the same as the fund's net asset value, which you can think of as the price you would get if you calculated the value of the portfolio that the fund holds. And so ETFs can trade at a premium or discount to net asset value, and that's the quantity I'm interested in looking at. The reason is that what really makes ETFs go is they have a mechanism for adding money to the fund or taking money out of the fund in response to investor demand, and that same mechanism serves also to cause the market price and the net asset value to tend to be pretty close together. Here's how that works. Let's say in a corporate bond ETF, investor interest is such that more people want to put money into the fund than take money out. Well, in that trading in the market, that means that the market price of those ETF shares will tend to rise to a premium to net asset value. At that point, what will tend to happen is there's each ETF has a group of firms that are called authorized participants, or APs, and they're the usual Wall Street suspects who have the contractual right to go into the broad marketplace, buy up a portfolio of securities that closely resembles the portfolio that the ETF is holding, and deliver those securities into the fund, receiving in exchange newly created ETF shares, and then they can do whatever they want to with those ETF shares. So the way you can think about it is they get to buy securities at net asset value, deliver them to the fund in exchange for new ETF shares, and then sell those shares at that premium. And there's an arbitrage profit in it for them, but that also and that's sort of fair compensation for the valuable activity of adding assets to the fund and also tying the market price to net asset value. So the fact that they have this profit is not a problem of any kind. But think about what's going to control both their behavior and their ability to profit. It's really going to be the transaction costs involved in buying up that portfolio of securities that go into the fund. So if liquidity is poor and transaction costs are high, then the APs, the authorized participants, will only be motivated to enter the picture once the ETF premium has grown large. But if liquidity is good and transaction costs are low, then they can profitably undertake that arbitrage even when the premium is really quite small. And so the result is the ETF premium can tell us about the liquidity in the market. So what I've done is I've taken a look at a daily end-of-day ETF premium and discount for two popular bond exchange-traded funds, the iShares Intermediate Corporate Bond Index ETF, ticker CIU, and the iShares iBoxx Dollar Investment Grade Corporate Bond ETF, ticker LQD. LQD has the longer history, so I'll direct you to the graph that displays those data. And what I've done is I've just calculated the end-of-day discount or premium for every day for as long a history as I could get, going back to 2002 in the case of LQD, and plotted them. And if you look at the graph, that the LQD ETF graph, you'll see how I've displayed the data. What I've done is I've divided the data into quarterly intervals and then plotted a box plot for each of those quarterly intervals. So each of those funny-looking oblong boxes represents 3 months' worth of data. And the way to read the box plot is the top end of the box represents the 75th percentile. The bottom end of the box represents the 25th percentile. So half of the data are inside the box. And then the whiskers sweep out that grow out of the top and bottom of the box, sweep out the rest of the range of the distribution. Now, whether there are individual data points that look like outliers, those are plotted individually, and then the whiskers only go to the rest of the range. But if you look at that picture, that LQD graph, what it shows you is that before the financial crisis, roughly before 2008, let's say in 2005, on average, the LQD traded at a premium of 0.29%, and the daily standard deviation of that premium was 0.31%. Whereas if you look more recently, 2014, say, the average was half of that. The average premium was 0.14%, and the standard deviation was also 0.14%. So compared to 10 years ago, the LQD is trading at a smaller premium, and the dispersion of the premium is smaller than it was 10 years ago. So now think about what that means. That means that says, at least, you know, based on my hypothesis, that corporate bond liquidity has actually improved compared to before the financial crisis. By the way, if you look at the middle of the graph, 2008-2009, shouldn't be any surprise to anybody that things kind of went haywire. A lot of things did at that time, if you'll recall. But what I like about this measure is that this is a market-based measure derived from the actual data, or from the actual behavior of opportunistic profit-seeking firms. And, you know, in the general realm of pay attention to what I do rather than pay attention to what I say, it certainly looks to me from these data like the APs feel that corporate bond liquidity is just fine, thank you very much, regardless of what they may be saying for public consumption.
Okay, thank you, Jonathan. And those two graphs that Jonathan was referring to were on page 5 and 6 of his article. Okay, John Parsons.
Hello, everybody, and thanks very much for being here, the opportunity to talk with you about this. I'm going to make 4 quick points before we turn to the questions. Point number 1 is that the dealer industry is narrowly focused on its own business model, the way it produces liquidity, and that's a very incomplete picture of what customers get. So far in the public debate about this issue, a lot of that debate has originated from the dealers and has focused on the problems they have in delivering liquidity to the market, but hasn't really discussed whether the market is liquid, taking into account other business models for delivering the liquidity. Point number 2 is that technology is changing rapidly in how bonds are traded. It's creating new ways of getting the same liquidity using less of the dealer services. So if you look at the presentation that is on the website for me, page 3 of that presentation, which has the title, What's Missing, speaks to this point. This is a presentation that I gave to a meeting at the International Organization of Securities Commissioners. And so just to highlight a couple of changes in technology. So one example is the type of vehicle that Jonathan was speaking about a moment ago, bond ETFs. A bond ETF is, those have been growing significantly, and those give customers liquidity. They can buy in and out of the bond ETF, although turnover in the underlying bonds themselves may not move at all. So you get more liquidity for customers without seeing turnover in the actual bond market. Second, and probably more important for what we're seeing and about to see going on, second is electronic trading directly between customers. The ability these days to use computers, to use electronic exchanges, to do automated analysis of portfolios, we've all seen that over the last couple decades transform the equity markets. People thought that the bond markets were behind, but I think we've seen that the U.S. Treasury market has been transformed by that. It's happening as well in the corporate bond market. It's happening slower, and there are obstacles, but it's actually happening. And what that means is that asset managers, people who own large portfolios of bonds and sometimes have to get in and out, they have a greater ability to meet other buyers or sellers without going through dealers. That means a lot of the assets owned on the balance sheets of asset managers, which might be available for trade, are now actually in practice available for trade. So I think of it as latent liquidity in the past has now been mobilized by these new electronic means. So you have liquidity without having to go through the dealer. And a third source of these technological changes and other forms of liquidity is the new access to derivative markets as a result of the derivatives reforms that have been going on. So asset managers who are trying to control the risk of a portfolio of bonds and who are making decisions to get in and out of certain risks do not have to execute a specific bond trade quickly because they can make trades in the derivative positions to rebalance their exposure to various risks. And that enables them to take time to execute the bond trade. So once again, the customers have liquidity without the actual seeing that in the form of a trade. So point number 3 I want to make is that the metrics, the measures that are often being quoted about bond liquidity are misleading. Jonathan said a moment ago that it's difficult sometimes to measure liquidity, and his measure is trying to get at the bottom line for prices. But what you often see quoted out there are metrics that are try to substitute proxies for what liquidity is. For example, on page 4 of my presentation, the one titled Misdiagnosing Causality, I show a chart, which is from a BIS report back in March of this year. And that chart shows you that the average transaction size of U.S. investment grade bonds has been falling. So the large transactions are decreasing. That's the red line. The smaller transactions, the blue line, is increasing. And this is one of the kind of indicators that the dealer community points to in claiming that the liquidity is going down. Under some circumstances, watching how that kind of a measure changes over time might tell you something. But the danger is, because technology is changing, that measure is not a reflection of liquidity. It's a reflection of the changes in technology. So, for example, asset managers these days can break up a position that they want to sell into smaller trade sizes, break it into pieces, and parcel it out over time. So what you're observing is the changes in the technology, not the loss of liquidity. And so the fourth and final point I wanted to make is that this decline in dealer inventory that people also point to is actually a good thing. If you were to turn to page 6 of my presentation with the title Declining Dealer Inventories, this is a picture that has sometimes been pulled out in some of the discussions about the liquidity in the bond market. And it shows the amount of inventory in the primary dealers, primarily the bank dealers. And of course, it declined since the crisis, but people will also try to claim that it was lower than shortly before the crisis. And I just want to emphasize that this is something we wanted to see happen, that dealers were being subsidized through the too big to fail taxpayer backstop to hold large portfolios. They didn't have to measure the risk and they didn't bear the full cost. And so if you're going to get rid of the taxpayer backstop, you're going to be reducing that inventory, and that's a good thing. If you think about it, a large fraction of this inventory was really bank-controlled hedge fund investments, things that we aren't really effective inventory providing a service to customer, but something which added to systemic risk. If we were talking about any other industry and we saw them successfully decreasing inventory, we would think of that as a good thing. Back in the 1980s and 1990s, there was all the talk about the automobile industry successfully implementing just-in-time manufacturing in order to lower inventories and by that means lower costs. And so what I've been trying to talk to you about here in these points I'm making is how in the bond market, new technologies have created the ability to provide the same services to customers by different avenues than the typical dealer inventory and to mobilize inventories in different ways. And hopefully we can shift the focus to what the customers are actually receiving and not to a particular business model that's failing to provide that to the customers. Thanks very much.
Okay, so now let's open it up to questions. Marvin, I think people have to unmute their phones. Is *6 the way to do that?
Yes, Marcus. If anyone has a question for any of our presenters, you can hit *6 to unmute your line. Please be sure to introduce yourself and let the speaker know what press outlet or office that you're with. Are there any questions?
Hi, this is Zach Warmbrot with Politico. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Thanks. This is a question for any or everyone on the panel. But you know, having looked into this, I mean, are you satisfied with what you're hearing from regulators or lawmakers in terms of how they're responding to what the industry is saying about this issue, or do you feel like there's more education needed?
I think this is Marcus Stanley from AFR. I do think that regulators are not really accepting these claims from the dealers, that we have to go back to the future here and permit once again highly leveraged inventory buildups by banks and dealers that are at the center of the system. I don't think that regulators are accepting that argument, and I don't think that they should accept that argument. So I think that that is positive. And we've seen some thoughtful discussion from the Treasury on this that I think really recognize that. What I think we would like to see from the regulators is movement on this agenda of addressing possible market instability that may come out of electronic trading practices. We've seen a lot of discussion of movement in that direction from the CFTC and SEC, but we haven't really seen much movement. And I think also action on the agenda that that Mary Jo White laid out in terms of liquidity risk management by asset managers and funds, that's something that's been laid out. I know the SEC is working on it, but it's unclear what their timeline is to execute on it or exactly what will be involved in it.
And so you're saying you'd like to see more action on potential safeguards for electronic trading in the corporate bond market, or is it more general than that?
Well, I think it's more general than that. We've seen problems in the equity market too. But if we're talking about if we're talking about issues in the corporate bond and treasury markets, then that's where you would want to focus. It's not to say there aren't problems in the equity market. It's just kind of this where we're discussing the credit markets. And frankly, the overall bond credit markets are larger and more important than the equity markets. So I don't know, Wally, John, others, do you have thoughts on this? Because I know you studied.
So this is John Parsons. I would emphasize that this debate about bond market liquidity, as Mark has indicated, it's a looking backward kind of debate. How come we don't have the kind of dealer market that we used to have? And that's exactly the wrong thing to be focusing on, precisely because the ability to do the electronic communication and electronic trading, the huge computing power that's now at the disposal of asset managers, that's the new world going forward. And on the one hand, that's great opportunity for lowering costs, but it's also something that invites abuse if the regulators don't have an agenda for bringing that technology to the fore in a way that is done fairly, that makes the market work in a sensible, competitive fashion. And so we absolutely need the regulators to be looking forward to how to enable this new technology, but also to how to make sure that it's done fairly, effectively, so that the markets are stable and efficient. And we've seen that the regulators have been way behind the ball in the equity markets and it needs a lot of attention.
This is Wally Turbeville. I would maybe even go a bit further. The fact is that the way the markets work now, even it sort of challenges the whole concept of liquidity, and what the liquidity is certainly there are those that think just mere volume of trading is liquidity, so that there are offers to on both sides of bid ask spread. On the other hand, if liquidity is so ephemeral that it can depart and reverse from buy interest to sell interest instantaneously because of the technology, then that's not, maybe it's not liquidity, or certainly not the kind of liquidity that used to exist. So while the discussion has been from the financial sector really talking about a kind of liquidity that doesn't even exist anymore, because to try to achieve some purpose, it's pretty clear that, like, for instance, the Fed is not fooled by that, although there could be some discussions, especially in, you know, in the legislative branch and whatnot, that where they're not as technically capable for obvious reasons. But the bigger challenge, I think, is right, and this certainly is what John's talking about, is to actually address the new world, the new world and the new activity that that we refer to as liquidity, which, and just recognize it's not the same as the old kind of liquidity, and understand that things have to change, and try to understand how that affects trading markets and how it affects capital allocation and the cost of the true cost of capital to the American economy, which doesn't seem to be doing very well in terms of raising capital. So, you know, the questions can be raised and should be.
Yeah, and I'll echo John's comment that, you know, I think when most people think of securities markets, they think in terms of the stock market, which by and large is a broker or an agency market, and really the bond market traditionally has been a dealer or a principal market, and there's no reason that it has to be, but it historically has been. Some of the changes that John and Wally have been talking about, you know, you could see them tending to drive more toward an agency and away from the principal model, and you know, I think regulators need to be alert to those changes to make sure that they work to the benefit of the public interest and not against it.
Thank you.
Are there any other questions from any of the callers? You could hit star 6 to unmute, and please direct your question to a particular presenter. Please announce yourself and your press outlet or office that you're with. Any questions?
Hi, this is Matt Stoller.
Okay.
This is Matt Stoller with the Senate Budget Committee. I am wondering how important liquidity actually is. Why is there so much? It's sort of kind of a basic question: is why does liquidity matter that much?
Well, I mean, look. I think that liquidity is the importance of liquidity is consistently overrated in one sense, in the sense that more liquidity is not necessarily better. You know, more liquidity can represent overtrading, and it can represent excessive risk taking and all kinds of things. But certainly, liquidity services, in the sense of the ability to convert a security into cash on the secondary market, is something that financial markets provide and should provide a reasonable element of. And it would be difficult to raise money by issuing securities unless people had some confidence that they could sell it on the secondary market. So, you know, it's certainly something that financial markets provide and should provide, but it's not something where more liquidity is always better. I mean, every time you see a financial bubble or excessive activity in purely financial markets that inflates asset prices to a level that's out of line with their actual value, you know, that's being driven by what one might call excessive liquidity. So it's a balance that has to be struck. But
yeah, if you look from the point of view of a buy and hold investor, in one sense, day-to-day liquidity isn't that important, but actually in another sense it is. And the sense in which it is important to the buy and hold investor is that the ability to build diversified portfolios depends on the ability to buy relatively small positions at reasonable transaction costs. If you're going to pay, you know, sort of traditional full-service brokerage commissions from the old days, you can't build a portfolio of dozens of securities. Whereas if liquidity is greater and trading costs are lower, you're able to do that. Even if you're only going to buy the positions in once and then hold them for a very long time, it's still valuable to have some liquidity. So at the margin, it works for investors, but I also agree with the statement that it's overrated because it can lead to sort of excessive churn in the market, which doesn't necessarily have economic value.
I kind of wanted to get to that, the excessive emphasis on liquidity.
I think that it's probably a reasonable thing to do is to postulate that there's a level of liquidity that's optimal, and over that not so much, and over that there's in fact a sort of a distortive drag, because if you're an investor and you're looking at a portfolio, the problem is if you're looking at your own performance as an investor and only looking at very short term results, that means that that's easy to measure, and that's something that's available, but it doesn't suggest necessarily that there will be good long term results, which sort of changes the way investors behave more broadly. So. The fetishization of liquidity can become an overall economic problem, and it certainly isn't directly related to the issue of market integrity and the potential for some kind of crash occurring, because those things can occur and have occurred and don't necessarily lead to a crisis situation. A crisis situation is a much more elaborate thing. So I think there's a perfectly legitimate question to raise: how much liquidity is good liquidity, and how much can there be bad liquidity, and where does those change? And the economics profession is really sort of very much on the early stages of even thinking how to precisely measure that, but it's fairly obvious to some of us that we're on the, in the United States anyway, we're on the other end of the spectrum, where there's too much.
Hey guys, this is Ryan Tracy from the Wall Street Journal. So it seems like there's agreement among the presenters that this whole argument of, you know, from the big dealer banks that liquidity has been negatively impacted, and so we should roll back the capital rules or something else, is not one that you agree with. But setting the idea of rolling back the existing rules aside, it does seem like there are a number of changes going on, you know, either in the market, like high-frequency trading and the growth of the asset management industry broadly, and the regulations potentially playing a role in sort of reshaping the way the markets work. So if you put aside the idea of rolling them back, looking forward, what do you all think, like, regulators should be looking at here? Are there problems that need to be solved, or are you saying that, you know, that the problems that we hear about are overblown in terms of, like, potential for volatility and swings and stuff like that? I hope that was clear. Sorry, I'm rambling a bit. But
so this is John Parsons. I think we are way behind the ball on automated trading. I think we're still behind the ball on equities, and we've had experience with that for a number of years. I think so far what we seem to do is define a few things as wrong, like spoofing, but we haven't got an affirmative definition of what's a good, healthy market, what are rules that are okay. So we let the exchanges come up with an infinity of order types, and we wait to find problems, and we don't have an ability to say, this is a well-ruled market. This, we can't even audit the markets because we don't have the capacity to cope with the volume of orders and cancellations and the data feeds that we have. So I think there's a huge task before the regulators to provide some sort of definition of what is a healthy automated trading market. And that doesn't mean that they have a 250-page rule book, but a
some principles and some ability to audit and affirm whether those principles are being kept to would be a very important direction for regulators in all of these markets to move forward.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I also think that the agenda on asset managers, which was laid out by Mary Jo White last year, and I think it's also supported by FSOC, I think we could sort of blunder ourselves. The truth is that the regulation of asset managers right now is in terms of the actual requirements, it's very unclear, and there's several decades of no action letters from the SEC concerning matters like how derivatives are handled by asset managers, there are various exemptions that have been given in terms of the promises of liquidity that asset managers can make to their customers, the growth of asset managers in the securities lending markets. These are all situations where asset managers could effectively get themselves into a leverage-like situation where they've promised return, they promised liquidity or certain fixed amounts of money to people, and they're under pressure to provide that very rapidly, and they can't provide it. I think that in principle, the SEC's agenda in terms of looking at liquidity risk management, looking at derivatives, looking at stress testing, is the right agenda. But we have to see the execution on it. In response, though, to your question, you know, are we headed for some kind of big disruption? You know, the old dealer intermediary system produced, you know, a world historic crash and disruption at the level of Great Depression levels, and that was really facilitated by the ability of those dealers to build up these massive leveraged inventories of bonds, on borrowed money, and they ended up having to sell them extremely rapidly when a large share of those bonds, the mortgage-backed securities and synthetic CDOs, turned out to be, you know, worth much less than they were supposed to be worth. So I don't think we're looking at anything like that on the of that scope on the horizon. But I think we're looking for need to, you know, continually update our rules and really lay out our vision and make that vision clear in areas like electronic trading and asset management, risk management.
I think one of the subjects that's coming up in some of the political discussion now, and one that is remains to be seen what the real outcomes are, is to ask the question: is some of this not just that? Is there a risk of another crash like 2008? But is what good is this? Some of this activity doing for us and. And what harm is it doing in terms of things like incomes and inequality and sustainability? So those kinds of questions are actually, you know, becoming part of the discussion. Right now, the regulators aren't so much mandated for those kinds of things, although you could, you know, perhaps the Fed to some extent. But I think that's part of what the subject matter will be. It's kind of interesting that the whole liquidity issue being raised by the financial sector itself is actually kind of an interesting entree into that discussion. So, you know, because they're raising the issue of liquidity. Well, what is liquidity? What is it now? What is it under the modern system? Is it really worth what we seem to think it is, which means there's an infinite value to liquidity. All liquidity is always better. Well, probably not. So it sort of drives you to think about what are you doing for me lately in the current configuration of what the system, of how the system works.
Okay. Do we have more questions? Okay, we've almost reached 4 o'clock, so just we'll ask one more time. Do we have any more questions before we close the call? Okay, hearing none, thank you very much, everybody, for joining us, and please feel free to get in contact with Americans for Financial Reform if you have further questions or want to do any follow-up. Also happy to connect you with any of the other presenters. Thanks very much, everybody.
All right, thank you, everybody.